Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have, I think, a very interesting panel, and we have some very important people who have been kind enough to give their time, and I think that we need to get going without further ado. Today, we're going to discuss the subject of vital importance to all of us, our environment. Now, we in the power field are rather in the middle on this subject. We must provide the electric power that has, in my opinion at least, done more than anything else for the benefit of mankind. It has relieved him from the animal-like enslavement previously required merely to eke out a living of the barest existence. And in the early days, his lifespan of 35 years was not uncommon. And it's increased to providing him with a lifespan of perhaps double that, at least, and during which he has the leisure to enjoy it. Now, in providing this great humanitarian service, we do produce pollutants in several forms, and we may not have been giving sufficient attention to this in the past. But we do recognize our responsibilities and are prepared to face them, as evidenced by the interest and by what we hope to be a frank discussion of these facts and to hopefully ways of overcoming some of these ills. Now, we're very fortunate to have this group of people. Their description and their biographies are in your program. So I will make their introduction very briefly, and I will ask you to withhold any applause until the introductions are completed. Take them as they are listed in the program. We have the second gentleman here, Mr. William R. Gould, Senior Vice President, Southern California Edison. He's a mechanical and nuclear engineer who is the 1970 recipient of the Engineer of the Year Award of the California Institute for Advancement of Engineering. Next to him is Mr. R. Philip Hammond, Director of Nuclear Desalination Program of Oak Ridge National Laboratories, a chemical engineer long associated with the nuclear, including being a member of the U.S. delegations to the Geneva Conferences on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. Next, we have Mr. J.P. Vikasan, Jr., Public Utilities Commissioner for the State of California. He's a lawyer by trade, by profession, and has a long record of public service. Next to him is Mr. Frederick H. Warren, head of the new Office of Advisor on Environmental Quality of the Federal Power Commission. He is a graduate of West Point and also of the Graduate School of Princeton, where he received advanced civil engineering degrees. He also has a long active record in the atomic field. And we have Mr. James E. Watson, Manager of Power for Tennessee Valley Association, or TVA. Authority, I'm sorry. A mechanical engineer whose career has been totally with TVA, including the position of electrical engineer. He also has a long record of public service. And the gentleman next to me is Mr. Philip Sporn, past president of American Electric Power Company and consultant to the industry. Mr. Sporn is an electrical engineer, but he is truly educated in almost all facets of engineering and in a broad range of other disciplines. He often has been referred to as Mr. Public Utility. I believe, I'm right in this, that he is the only power engineer to be honored by election to the National Academy of Sciences. But having worked for him many years, I know that truly he is an engineer, and he is also a member of the National Academy of Engineering. He's a fellow of IEEE, and I'm proud to say is a member of the Power Group. His record of public service certainly is outstanding. And that's, if you want to express your appreciation to these gentlemen being here, let's do it now. The pattern of our meeting will be a keynote talk by Mr. Sporn entitled Our Environment, Options on the Way into the Future. This will require about an hour to an hour and 5 minutes, he tells me, following which we will take a 15-minute break. Following the break, each panelist will have 10 minutes in which to express his thoughts. The meeting will then be open to discussion. The floor monitors will, wherever possible, bring microphones to those wishing to ask questions. Now, the entire session will be tape recorded, and additionally, the question and answer period will be recorded by a court stenographer. Now, Mr. Sporn, the podium is yours, and we give the gentleman a chance to move down to the front here for listen to you.
Thank you, Howard. Ladies and gentlemen, since the middle 60s, the growing alarm about man's corruption of his environment, which had been developing in several segments of our society, has made its influence felt in the behavior of our scientific community. I had an experience recently that made me pause in my approach to this whole question of environment and its repercussion on the question of public policy and electric power. Early last fall, the editor of Science asked whether I would write an editorial on the environmental debate that had developed in connection with proposed expansions of electric power generating facilities all over the United States. This debate and its effects had resulted in significant schedule setbacks for certain projects. Worse, there were indications that this was going to have some highly damaging effects on our economy. My editorial expressed the importance of energy and electric energy in our society, as well as the also obvious importance of the protection of our environment. I stressed the need for giving this problem much greater attention in three segments of our society. Namely, the government of the United States, the scientific and technological community, and the managers of the energy-producing industries. If, I stated, each of these carries out its particular function well, it would be possible to obtain both increased energy for man and protection of the environment. To my surprise, after the publication of this editorial, the editors of Science were literally deluged with correspondence, a large part of it from the academic community all over the country. More letters apparently were written than on any other editorial that had ever appeared in Science, but the letters, on the whole, were not complimentary. The editors chose from this mass of letters six, which they published with my rebuttal in the issue of December the 19th. But many of the writers felt my optimism was misguided, if not dishonestly conceived, and that there was no solution except rigid birth control. Still others felt it was only our selfishness that made us want to enjoy air conditioning and refrigeration, and they themselves would be willing to give up these unnecessary luxuries to save our environment, disregarding the fact that the residential part of our electric energy use constitutes only 1/3 of our total electrical requirements and only 7% of our total energy use. Others propose that we ration energy to the next 100 million who are going to be born. These critics apparently never bothered with the question of why they ought to be given such third-rate treatment as compared with the 200 million who preceded them in becoming inhabitants of the United States. There were quite a number who were convinced that it was only our capitalistic society that brought about this problem, that but for the greed for increased sales and profits, the matter could be taken care of. They chose to disregard that the same pattern with respect to energy and its use is being repeated in many parts of the world, where electric energy is not an activity open to private enterprise, but is handled by the state. For example, in Russia, Italy, France, England, and in many other countries. In general, it can be said that we received sincere, even agitated, concern, but no balanced approaches to the problem. For example, if we agree that population control is a must, the question is at what level do we set the control? Can we slow down by 15% any conceivable practical system of legislation or social enactment in a matter of 3 decades, the growth of the United States from the present level of 204 million people to a level of 275 million, 45 million less than that indicated by the President of the United States in a recent State of the Union message as our likely population in the year 2000? Be that as it may, I've considered the many facts of this discussion, and the following propositions need to be more closely examined. One, we're a population currently of 204 million people. We may well be 300 to 320 million by the year 2000. Nothing except some great catastrophe will alter this substantially. Second, we will need to produce much more than we do now in order to support this increased population, and we need to do so by making our entire society more productive. We need to do this to make possible improved standards of living, to provide for national defense, and for helping other less fortunate societies. We must also solve the many difficult social-economic problems, such as those of the cities, of environment, of schools, of clearing up our slums, and of integrating our society into a unified whole. Third, we have very definitely a major problem in national defense. If there is a threat of an atomic war, the danger is much greater if it's being initiated from the communist than from our side. Not because we are more virtuous than they are, but because we're not so badly motivated by fear. Nor do we appear as ideologically fixed and determined that the world has to be unified on one social economic system. Fourth, it has taken us a long time to get to the state of degradation of our environment. And it has taken us additional time to become awakened to this. Even our scientific community has lagged in awakening to our danger. 10 years ago, the academic community didn't blow any loud horn of warning that I was able to hear. Fifth, thus we cannot solve these problems overnight. It will not only take time, but vast resources in manpower, in materials, and in complex and skilled technology. Therefore, we cannot afford to be spendthrift in the use of resources. We must carry out this operation efficiently. Sixth, in solving this entire problem, which may take more than $100 billion, we cannot afford to ruin our economy. We need to maintain it vital and vigorous and more productive than it is today in order to have the necessary increments to dedicate to the business of fighting pollution. Seven, but that is simply impossible to conceive, are becoming more productive without the help of technology. The great increment in national productivity that has taken place in the last 60 years has occurred only by virtue of technology and its application to human and material resources, powered, all of it made mobile by ever-increasing amount of inanimate energy. This is why we need a better understanding of this whole business. And we hope that some contribution will be made by this seminar. I want to take a few minutes on discussing the importance and significance of energy and electric energy in our society. We are today the most powerful and most productive nation in the world, and our citizens enjoy a level of economic welfare unapproached by any other nation today or in the history of man. We have reached that position by exploiting our natural resources and tools to a degree unmatched by any other society. Throughout the long period when man was dependent upon his own energy, supplemented by the contributions of his animal servants, his progress in the production of food, clothing, and other goods was extremely limited. Real progress in productivity began when mechanical energy ushered in the Industrial Revolution in England approximately 200 years ago. Only then could more than a relatively small segment of the population aspire to and achieve standards of material welfare at or above the bare subsistence level. The benefits of such progress may not be as well distributed as they might, and they might have been obtained only at certain costs. But the overall gain to society of such benefits cannot fairly be disputed. We ought to be intelligent enough to improve our system of distributing the benefits of technological progress and to reduce the cost of such progress without automatically concluding that what we need is less progress. Lamentably, but unavoidably, it is important that we continue economically so strong that we can support over a long period of time an adequate system of armament while we maintain our civilian economy in a flourishing state. Thus, we must take care of defense, in addition, produce enough goods and services to take care of the living requirements of our growing population at the highest standards we've accepted as the national goal. We must also produce enough additionally to strengthen the defense of our allies and potential allies who are less fortunately situated than we are, and we must help them to raise their own level of welfare. This means we need to help them expand their industry where it is already established, or help them industrialize where little or no industrialization exists. One of the important means for achieving these objectives is the use of mechanical energy so as to diminish the oppressive dependence on the work of human muscle. Energy is used through the medium of machines and tools, which it powers in industrial complexes. These machines need energy to become mobile and productive. Thus, in our day-to-day living or work, and in our system of defense, energy in many diversified forms gives vitality and is indispensable to our ability to carry out and achieve whatever the particular task calls for. Energy, which is so important to our society, is, however, frequently taken for granted, and thus not really understood, and its importance is overappraised almost as frequently as it is overvalued. The Industrial Revolution, which caused a rapid expansion of production, productivity, and rising levels of human welfare, is a complex historical development that could be examined from many different points of view, including social, political, and economic organization, major religious and philosophical movements, scientific and technological methodology, and trends. One important aspect is the progress made in harnessing inanimate energy to the human, productive, creative, and cultural activity. When looked at from the latter viewpoint, we find that industrialization, economic growth, and material welfare are almost always associated with rising levels of energy consumption. This would be found to be true in a critical analysis of the functioning of any given society taking over an extensive period of time. It will also be found true when comparing different economies over the same period of time. The level of production or income is highly correlated with the level of energy use. The ready acceptance, without further probing, of this observation has led at different times and in many parts of the world to some highly misleading conclusions about the part that energy can play in the economic development of a society and about the cause and effect relationship between energy and human welfare. Three more observations about energy and electric energy. The first, when Edison on September 4, 1882, inaugurated the first commercial electric services, with a load of 400 lamps, each drawing 83 watts. The total demand reached was 33 kilowatts. Today, with an established peak of 260 million kilowatts of demand, with an annual generation of approximately 1,500 billion kilowatt hours, we have seen a growth in electric demand of 8 million fold, or roughly by 7 orders of magnitude. And electric energy represents 23% of our total energy use. By the year 2000, the best estimate now is that our society of 320 million people of that date will need to use approximately 7 trillion or 8,000 billion kilowatt hours, and this will represent 50% of all the energy that society will then use. An important corollary question is this. Can this occur if our energy utilization devices do not become electrified sufficiently to require this quantity of electric energy? Second, of the three observations, electric energy entered the American home rather slowly. 50 years ago, the average home used approximately 700 kilowatt hours a year. By 1970, the home will be using on the average 7,000 kilowatt hours, a growth by a full order of magnitude. The all-electric homes, however, of which there are going to be 4.25 million by the end of 1970, will use 21,000 kilowatt hours. Yet the major need for electric energy is not in the home. As I pointed out earlier, that is only 30 to 35% of the total, and the balance is used in giving life and mobility to our industrial machine and to our commercial establishments. Third, electric power was discussed in depth 40 years ago in the Congress of the United States, and the basic national policy with regard to electric energy and its use was established at that time. Essentially, it calls for, and I quote, an abundant supply of electric energy throughout the United States with the greatest possible economy, end of quote. And the injunction in the Holding Company Act of 1935 and the Federal Power Act of 1935 is to so interpret and enforce these acts as to bring about that abundance and maximum economy. This was not based upon what was necessary for profits or maximum utilization of energy, but to assure the welfare of the people of the United States. Let us take a look at the sources of our electric power. I believe it's very important that we have a clear understanding of the various primary energies that constitute the source of our electric energy. For this purpose, I want to refer to the first table, which the projectionist will please throw on the screen. Can we have the first slide? And could we also have... Good. There is indicated, as you will see from this slide, a sextupling of energy in this interval 1966-2000. But as time goes on, the doubling of energy use every 10 years has disappeared. Second, the rapid decline in overall primary energy supply of oil and natural gas generation to about one-third, and the even greater decline of hydro to about one-fourth of its 1966 importance by the year 2000. Third, the relatively firm position that coal is shown maintaining in the energy supply picture. Fourth, the remarkable growth in nuclear energy from representing only 0.6% in the year 1966 to 50% in the year 2000. And finally, that in the year 2000, coal and nuclear energy will between them represent 85.6% of all primary energy. Could we have the lights, please? There is no indication at the present time that our society will be able to obtain its electric energy requirements unless it is able to exploit coal and nuclear power. Now about the contaminant characteristics of the five fuels entering into electric energy generation. All fuels, including hydro, have characteristics associated with the use press with their use, which present potential hazards to living organisms. This fact could be utilized as an argument to support outlawing any specific fuel or all of them. From Table 1, however, which I just showed you, it is clear that while today we can perhaps contemplate with equanimity, from the standpoint of the country as a whole, the elimination of oil as a primary fuel for electric energy, and in terms of 1987, we could perhaps go further and be unconcerned about the elimination of hydro, and by the year 2000, by the elimination of gas. Incidentally, gas is the least objectionable of our fossil fuels from the standpoint of pollution. We cannot do without coal and nuclear energy. Let us examine coal and nuclear power as pollutants. The two pollution sources emanating from coal are particulate matter and gaseous pollutants. Particulate matter is the residue left after coal has been subjected to combustion. It is a complex compound. It appears as a finely powdered ash or as disintegrated abrasive material formed by contact of the hot molten ash with water. The latter part offers no problem since it's completely collectible and disposable. Sometimes it has significant commercial value. Part of this particulate matter is carried through the boiler and suspension in the effluent gas. It again is today capable of complete collection by electrostatic precipitators, which have been developed, at least the manufacturers so claim, to an efficiency of between 99% and 99.5%. Some of us still have to prove that to ourselves. As to gaseous pollutants, the principal three are carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and oxides of nitrogen. A fourth, radioactivity released in burning coal, sometimes included under the same heading, appears as a matter of fact mainly in the ash. Let us examine these gaseous pollutants in more detail. A modern 1,000 megawatt electric plant burning 9,000 tons of coal per day will produce and discharge in the same period approximately 30,000 tons of carbon dioxide. This may be a significant pollutant. But the truth is that the effect of carbon dioxide on our environment is not known. It is essential to tree and plant life. It is used by them in photosynthesis, producing oxygen. It is absorbed by the oceans, but an imbalance may produce the so-called greenhouse effect. This, we are told, will raise the Earth's temperature, which will melt the ice caps, which will raise the levels of the oceans, which will result in a holocaust, drowning of all the world's coastal cities. But we do not know how solid this projected greenhouse effect is. The Earth's average temperature has dropped a bare 0.2 of a degree centigrade since 1945, although the carbon dioxide content of the air keeps increasing every year. Some have argued the increased carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere will reduce incident radiation to the Earth, thereby producing a chilling effect. I would like you to cogitate fully on these statements. Despite the sophistication we've achieved in our energy technologies, we do not know much about carbon dioxide, which we've been producing since the discovery of fire. As to sulfur dioxide, the same 1,000 megawatt electric plant burning 3 1/3% sulfur coal will generate 600 tons of sulfur dioxide per day. This could have detrimental effects on human beings, particularly those subject to respiratory ailments. But we know almost nothing about sulfur dioxide effects on primates, let alone human beings. We have been experimenting with systems of recovering sulfur dioxide and converting it into solid sulfur, for which there is a constantly growing market. Now, by the way, a scarce market. In the interim, we have developed a technology of diffusing sulfur dioxide concentrations to almost certain inoffensive levels by the use of the tall stack, built so far to heights of 1,200 feet, and we certainly can go even higher. This is a good interim solution to the sulfur problem, but cannot be accepted as permanent in the sense of for all time. Now as to oxides of nitrogen. Nitrogen dioxide combines with water in the body to form nitric acid. A 1,000 megawatt plant, still the same plant, burning 9,000 tons of coal a day, will discharge 80 tons of nitrogen dioxide in the atmosphere per day. but again for the immediate future that Tolstoy can diffuse it. We need more research into means of capturing and converting it to a useful purpose. Of these major pollutants and of the other complex compounds produced by the spectrum of the relatively simple process known as combustion, it can be said we don't know the specific effects of most. We cannot separate individual and synergistic effects, and so it is difficult to apply intelligence to determining acceptable levels until substantial additional information is collected. Fortunately, the story for ionizing radiation is more comforting. Despite earlier allegation to the contrary, a report issued in mid-January 69 by the Bureau of Radiological Health of HEW concludes that nuclear stations represent, and I quote, a greater overall radiological burden on the environment than do fossil fire plants, even though the latter release about five times more radioactivity from the stack than do pressurized water reactors, but 14 times less than BWRs. In any event, their radiation is a factor, and while, as I've just stated, a comforting factor because of our better knowledge of radiation effects, that does not imply the total absence of any problems. As to nuclear fuel, nuclear reactors themselves do not release any particulate matter, and since there's no combustion involved in the process of heat release, there is no pollution resulting from the formation and or release of any of the oxides of carbon, sulfur, or nitrogen. Thus, it would seem that nuclear fuel would be the ideal primary energy source. And it is, except for two unique adverse characteristics, one of them quite reparable, but evolving technology. This is the greater thermal pollution, a headache to current nuclear units. This is attributable to the low temperature at which light water reactors are forced to operate. Advanced reactors using higher temperatures will result in higher thermal efficiencies, thereby eliminating any difference between fossil and nuclear fuel in the thermal pollution area. None of this is to say that I'm happy even with the best fossil fuel conversion efficiencies currently attainable. The need to reject 60% of the heat generated by fuel because of metallurgical limitations on the initial temperature involved in the Carnot cycle will continue as a hard fact of life until we get some new metals to permit economically feasible higher temperatures or until some direct conversion cycle becomes feasible. To summarize, the rise in temperature of the condensing medium takes place whether the primary fuel is coal, oil, gas, or nuclear. This can be seen more clearly from the next table. Could we have the next slide, please? Here, I have shown the comparative heat rejection potential from various generating plant systems, and you can see here that from that standpoint, the liquid metal fuel breeder, when we get it, will be a great improvement over the present light water reactor and will eliminate its handicap and will even be an improvement over the current fossil fuel job. Lights, please. The second adverse characteristic of nuclear energy are its radioactive pollutants. There are a number of these. To start with, they're low-level liquid wastes. Both the PWRs and the BWRs have their cores cooled by primary water circuit. Fission products, activation products, including corrosion in liquids, are collected for evaluation and release. They're gathered through conventional techniques, such as the mineralizers and filters, by evaporation and absorption. The more active of such waste are concentrated by evaporation, mixed with concrete and shipped for storage off-site. The lower-level radioactive wastes are eventually released to the condenser cooling water discharge at concentration levels sufficiently low to permit drinking by the general public. Tritium, which is inseparable by any practical process from ordinary water, is produced, but in small amounts as a fission product, and most of it is retained in the fuel. Additional tritium comes from chemicals which may be added to the reactor coolant systems. It generally occurs in the form of tritiated water. A great deal of work has shown that it does not concentrate in animal tissue. It cannot get higher on the average than the value of the tissue water, and that in turn cannot get to a higher value than the water in the food and water the animals consume. Charges that tritium is a particular genetic hazard have, I believe, been convincingly refuted. Thus, we have radioactive isotopes. Then we have the radioactive isotopes of the noble gases, xenon and krypton. These gases escape from fuel elements, which have cladding defects, and because they are essentially inert chemically, they remain in free form in the reactor coolant. The isotopes which do escape, with the exception of krypton 85, have short lives and decay rapidly, and thus can be controlled by holdup to permit radioactive decay. As to krypton 85, while it has a half-life of 10¾ years, its slow rate of release and consequent low density of radiation is such that the United States Public Health Service studies indicate that even though present planned design and operating methods are used through the year 2000, radiation exposure to the general public from its release and worldwide dispersion will not exceed approximately 1% of the radiation guides recommended by national and international standards. Despite the publicity they've been getting, the radiation standards are far more soundly based than the adversaries of the atom would lead one to believe, and even if krypton were to become a problem, I would expect it would be possible to extract it at a tolerable cost. I am also impressed by the data obtained to date from operating power reactors, which show that a person living just off-site would receive annual radiation exposures equivalent to the additional radiation that a person would receive if he lived at the top of a 400-foot hill rather than in the valley at his base. Now, while some people have characterized radioactive effluents as the ultimate pollutant, I'm even more impressed by how much we know about radioactivity as compared with other pollutants and by the fact that man has survived quite well in an environment that has never been totally free of radioactivity since the birth of man. High-level wastes are produced during processing of spent fuel elements from nuclear reactors. These, however, are not processed or disposed of at the reactor site. They are removed from the fuel elements and concentrated in liquid form for permanent storage. This is not a significant technological and economic problem, as would be surmised by the public. From this, it becomes quite obvious that from the standpoint of pollution of the environment, nuclear power at the present time is certainly, with the exception of thermal pollution, which can be handled, preferable to any other fuel. The question is, therefore, why do we not, by a comprehensive national law, specify a date after which only nuclear generating capacity would be allowed to be added on the power systems of the United States and call for the existing generating capacity to be retired on a specified schedule and to pass out of the picture, say at the end of 20 years. Now, there's three strong reasons against this. The first is economic. And this is a double-edged sword. Not only would such a program involve severe disturbances in both the coal and natural gas industries, but to a limited extent in the oil industry also. It also definitely would result in raising electric energy costs throughout a substantial portion of the United States where nuclear power is as yet not competitive with fossil fuels, and particularly coal. And retirement of perfectly good capacity prematurely would materially aggravate the situation. The net effect of all of this would be a severe impact on the social economic welfare of the nation. The second is inadequate capacity. The economic damage that has been brought about as a result of the delay in completion on schedule of major nuclear capacity additions to the power systems of the United States is due in large measure to the rapid takeoff of atomic power starting in 1965. Neither an architectural engineering capability, nor a manufacturing capacity, nor in construction craftsmen is the nuclear power industry ready to take over the entire burden of expanding the United States, currently running at the rate of over 20,000 megawatts a year. Finally, as the third strong objection, reliability and availability. It has commonly been stated that there is a three-pronged approach to the question of adequate protection of service and the public from any harmful effects of nuclear power plants, consisting of, first, the achievement of superior quality in design, construction, and operation of basic reactor systems. Second, accident prevention safety features, such as emergency reactor shutdown systems designed into the plant. And third, consequence limiting safety features, such as containment shells to confine and minimize the escape of fission products if they should be released from the fuel into the reactor systems. All these are excellent and have been handled with responsible and dedicated concern by the utilities, the manufacturers, the architect engineers, and the Atomic Energy Commission in their review and licensing procedures. What is missing, however, is operating experience. By the end of this year, there will still be less than 10,000 megawatts of commercial nuclear capacity in operation in the United States, as contrasted with over 300,000 megawatts of conventional capacity. Thus, less than one-third of, less than, I'm sorry, less than 3%, or 3 1/3%. In the case of the latter, that is, in the case of conventional capacity, we have a record going back to 1882, integrating operating experience, extending over a period of several million megawatt years without a catastrophe. Thus, there is solid reason for all who have responsibility for assurance of performance in this great matter of electric energy production to have complete confidence in the adequacy of the design and the protective features that have evolved and become part of our technology in conventional fuels. I have no reason to doubt that we shall establish a similar record in nuclear fuel plants, but we do not yet have that experience to be completely relaxed. Before complete commitment to nuclear power, we need the benefit of accumulated experience. Now, having discussed generation, let's go on to the other area of electric energy, transmission distribution of electric power. Thomas Edison, with his clear engineering mind, placed the generating station right in the very center of the first load area, and this was very efficient. On the other hand, since the electrical grid he connected the generators into was a three-wire, 115-200-volt one, the distances he could furnish the service to were extremely limited. In fact, did not go much beyond several blocks. With the development of commercial electric services and industry, aided enormously by the introduction of alternating current, this unique advantageous arrangement had to be given up. The need for large spaces for storage areas for coal and ash, for condensing water, forced the generating stations to the borders of the large cities where space was at a lesser premium and more readily available, where water was present and coal could be brought in by barge. But it also involved higher voltages to get the power to the load centers, and then transformation to lower distribution voltages, thus the differentiation between transmission and distribution. But the functions exercised by an electrical line, particularly at higher voltages, may be multiple. It may serve not only as a bulk carrier of electric energy, but as a means of integrating separated, individually relatively small areas of electric service into a unified electric system. It may serve as a basic means of interconnecting two contiguous power systems, exchanging capacity when this is advantageous, but also serving to back up service of one system by the facilities of the other. At higher voltages, for example, at 138,000 volts, it could serve both as a transmission distribution line. In time, responsive to the demands for service efficiency and lesser intrusion on the landscape, the voltages of transmission increased from the very early 13,000 to 22,000, 44,000, 66,000, 132,000, 230,000, 345,000, 500,000, and very lately, as you've heard of this, at these meetings, to 765,000. The functions of these transmission lines multiplied. They became an indispensable part of every power system. The physical embodiment of transmission lines was carried out from the very earliest in two forms. The first was overhead construction. This involved bare electrical conductors supported on structures, wood at relatively low voltages, but steel, more and more as the voltages increased, with insulators which early in the art assumed a disc form. In the underground form, the conductor was completely insulated and protected, against environmental physical damage, for example, as a drag through the duct lines, and against moisture by an outside lead and later plaster covering. The insulated underground cable had a technical advantage in that the elements, wind, rain, ice, sleet, could not discommode it. It has, however, many disadvantages. Technologically, the insulation is subject to ionization and other reactions which cause it to fail. Economically, the finding and curing of a fault is invariably more difficult and time-consuming than in overhead structures. And the first, the capital cost, is greater on a per kilowatt basis by a factor running from 7 to 1 in cross-country areas to higher than 10 to 1 in crowded city areas. In the case of the highest voltages now being exploited, the technology of designing and building an underground conductor has not yet been developed. And it is too well developed at one voltage below that, 500,000 volts. Thus, these economic differences have a great bearing on the possible steps to eliminate overhead transmission distribution lines and their pollution. Now, what are these sources of pollution? There are three that are important. The first is a physical infringement on the landscape. The structures and their guys occupy space. This interferes with other uses of the same space. This infringement is increasing with the growth of electric power, which, as we've already noted, is currently doubling every 10 years. The second is safety. Safety to the people engaged in working on these areas and to the public in general. As far as the people in the industry are concerned, this is taken care of by careful selection through training and competent and responsible supervision. As the voltages increase, choice of personnel is much more selective, training is more rigorous, and responsibility is more continually functioning. The danger to the public is a relatively minor source of accident in our complex technological society, and it can be increased by more rigorous observance by the industry of safety codes and other safety measures. Finally, there is aesthetic pollution. There is no question that a considerable amount of landscape has been subject to this by poles supporting electrical conductors, going back to the days when there was no electric power industry, and the only electric industries we had were the telegraph and the telephone. But the aesthetic problem is one in education and responsibility on the part of managements and technologists in the power industry, and in systematic effort to design and build structures that are graceful in form while performing the technological function, and that they have the innate beauty of that outstanding airborne structure, the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Aesthetic pollution and physical infringement could, of course, be entirely taken care of by legislative fiat, which would set up a mandatory program of putting all transmission distribution structures underground by a certain date. It would, however, probably be a great social, not to say economic, error. The total investment in utility proper of the entire investor-owned industry at the end of 1970, based on actual figures for the end of 1968, is going to be $92 billion. My estimate, perhaps more accurately described as a guesstimate, of the cost of undergrounding the entire transmission distribution plant at current prices is transmission, $138 billion, distribution, $193 billion, an increase of $331 billion. With an original planned account reduced to retirement by $11 billion, this gives a new total utility plant account for the investor-owned portion of the industry of $412 billion. The corresponding figure, based on rather inadequate information for the governmentally owned sector of the industry, will be $16.95 billion plant account and cost of underground $53.2 billion. With reduction of the original plant account by $1.7 billion by retirement, this gives for the governmentally owned sector a new plant account of $68.5 billion as of 1970. The carrying charges at 16% and 8% on this $384 billion of increased facilities would be $57.5 billion per year. The increased operating maintenance costs would be $5.5 billion, giving a total of $63 billion. With tax credits, this might be reduced to $60 billion. But the 1968 projected gross was only $21.7 billion. Thus, to provide for operating and maintaining underground plant and the charges on the large increase in capital rates would have to be increased 3¾-fold. Now, this is so heavy a burden on the economy that it's utterly inconceivable that we would seriously consider imposing it. And so we can say that at this stage, we cannot simply cannot afford to place all the splendor on the ground, say in a period of 10 years or so, regardless of whether it's privately or governmentally owned and operated. Let me advert to what I call the Achilles heel of utility philosophy. Now, this sprang directly out of perhaps a too narrow preoccupation with meeting the almost endless and continuing demands for more and more electric energy as the years went along. Having watched the demand and consumption double decade after decade, those even of a conservative ten amount have been, with some minor exceptions, continuing their projections without assuming any serious impact from an environmental problem, fully confident that the provision for such growth would benefit their territory, their customers, and their enterprise. I myself have not been free from blame in this regard. As far as that limited approach is concerned, we've all been right. And the utilities are not the only ones postulating and blithely projecting expansion sans interruption tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, to quote Macbeth. We all need to ask, is it possible that environmental health might be an obstacle to this fantastic use, expanding use, of electric energy? I'm of the opinion that it would be possible to obtain both increased energy for man and environmental protection. But then I do not foresee continual doubling every 10 years in electric energy for the next 30 years, not to say 60 or 100 years. And my projections of electric energy use by the year 2000 have never been any greater so far than 7.2 trillion kilowatt hours. But what of the published statement by one utility that, quote, during the past 30 years, our peak of electric load has doubled every 6 years, and the prediction is that the steady growth will continue, end quote. Had this utility taken the trouble to determine the simple arithmetical fact that the continuation of its energy use at this rate, its energy growth, for a mere 30 years more would increase it more than 1,000-fold in terms of the starting point 30 years ago? Or if it continued for 60 more years at that rate, that will have increased its use 33,000-fold? Are there or are there not saturation factors? It is obvious that such past myopia leads to extravagant and potentially disaster-bearing result. What is needed is not to be panicked, but to recognize our duty to ourselves and even the enterprise of our particular concern, our society, our future generations, and undertake our corrective tasks without wrecking what we have built beautifully, but not flawlessly. To again quote a correspondent, and I quote, a reasoned assessment of the options that are open or their consequences to the extent they can be foreseen, end of quote. Well, that is the broad objective of this session that you and I are engaged in right now. And so I gave the title to this talk, quote, options on the way into the future, end of quote. Let's take a look at costs in economics. There are many people in our society, in our government, in our universities, and among men of goodwill in general, dedicated to the need of cleaning up our environment, who are completely unconcerned and indeed impatient with the idea of evaluating costs and exerting effort to bring these costs down to minimum levels. They are inclined to overlook the magnitude of the job and the great demand it will impose on the scientific, technological, planning, manufacturing, and building elements of our society and on the material human resources. They overlook the need to know in advance what we are walking into, the cost, the annual burden on our society, the likely benefits. To clean up the present pollution-infected wasteland, pollution from all sources, our automobiles and trucks, our steel, chemical, and food processing plants, our mines and paper mills, our broad range of other industrial plants, our sewage and garbage disposal systems, our residential, commercial, and industrial heating plants, and our industrial and commercial power plants, our public utility power plants and their economically feasible aesthetics, polluting overhead systems, will take a great deal of money and time. Experts, this means people who have at least taken the trouble to give the matter some thought, have guessed that it'll take nearly $125 billion in the next 10 years. I have a hunch that the guess will prove to have been too low, both on years and on the dollars. on the dollars by as much as 50% and on the years by a much greater factor. But to go back to the 125 billion of this amount, 30 billion will be required merely to halt pollution on the nation's waterways, added to which will be another 20 billion to be spent by cities and towns on their water systems. The probable cost of cleaning up the air that Americans breathe is an astronomical $60 billion. Even though a good deal, perhaps most of this, will have to come from government, federal and state in the main, the final source of the money will be the public. The public as consumers or as taxpayers or both. In addition, industry and the municipalities will be called upon for direct expenditures of approximately $15 billion for waste treatment facilities by plants and factories to meet existing water standards. In certain cooling water situations, to provide cooling towers and evaporating ponds, to bring sediment and mine drainage under control, to diffuse or otherwise bring to acceptable levels the sulfur dioxides and oxides of nitrogen, and to install tertiary sewage treatment plants at all locations where the installations now include only the secondary phase. These expenditures are on top of those already made by industry over the past 20 years that I estimate at $5 billion. It is true that these last expenditures are not as good as they might have been, but they're not as bad as they made out to be. Thus, trying to strike a reasonable horseback estimate of what additional expenditures are involved, we end up with the following figures. To clean up the waterways, $50 billion. To clean up the air, $60 billion. To clean up industrial installations, $15 billion. The total is $125 billion, minus zero, plus $60 billion. What about pollution damage? We can make some rough estimates, but these estimates are not more than elaborate guesses. A frequently quoted figure of annual air pollution damage in the United States is $11 billion. This is based upon an estimate of cleaning costs derived from smoke damage data for Pittsburgh in 1913, later adjusted to 1959 prices and 1958 population. The estimate of damage to health had been made at figures from 400 million to 2,000 million per year. I have used for this purpose a figure of 1.5 billion. And the damage to property on the basis of current costs has been made at the billion per year. Thus, we arrive at a total of damages of $13.5 billion per year. On the basis of this rough but best available calculation, we thus have a benefit ratio between damage eliminated and annual cost that gives a return of 11.5% on the huge investment, using the lower figure of investment. Without going into the method of measuring social costs and social value, it's obvious that it is the kind of investment that we ought not to approach with any fear of driving the country to bankruptcy, assuming rational disposition of the war and establishment of much-needed national priorities. Let me get down to public policy with respect to the power industry. In Table 3, which may we have, please, I have summarized the basic choices I believe we must adopt for the development of a program to bring about compatibility between electric power and expansion and the viable environment. As you note, in Table 3, which I've called Choices, the first is a commitment to stop abuse of our environment. Second, a rejection of the contention that the Earth is doomed. Three, not to panic. Accept the proposition that if we don't procrastinate, there's time to do the job. Four, determination on procedure to reverse the trend of environmental deterioration, which is, first, clean up the accumulated damage, and this work will take $125 billion, perhaps more, in 30 years. We must continue to be even stronger than we are now, spiritually, ethically, productively, and in unremitting dedication. Now, as I say, we need to examine these options and intelligently weigh the pros and cons of every policy for the future. And we start out with a certain set of assumptions, and we make certain choices, And we're definitely choosing, we're not going to continue at the present route. There are those who say, and we have spokesmen in every branch of our community, that we need to return to the days when we were a smaller society, a less consuming society. By the way, can we have lights, please? When we lived on a simpler civilization, when we produced a great deal less pollution on our environment, they want to move the clock back, figuring that is the only route to safety. But as will be shown, we cannot move the clock back. Pollution is with us. Our problem is how to handle it, to arrest it along its present trend line, and gradually to reverse the trend and clean up the accumulated mess. We have a great deal to help us and a great deal to guide us. We are first and foremost a technologic society. If we are to solve our problem, we need to undertake an expenditure of some $125 billion, perhaps more. To do this, we must be more productive than we have been in the past, so as to have available for these vast undertakings the increments above what it takes to support our society. We have become the most economically powered nation on the face of the earth because in the 60 years, 1910-70, we have increased our productivity fourfold. Our standard of living, our system of higher education, our system of defense, our social care, our leisure, our magnificent farms and industrial plant all came about because of that increase in productivity. And some of you will recall the president's address about battling the inflation we are in and his emphasis on productivity, which was one of the good points of his speech. Our national will is to continue to improve our standard of living, to rebuild our cities, to bring up the national level of welfare of our disadvantaged community, to modernize our transportation, and to clean up our environment. To do that, it is absolutely necessary that we continue to increase our productivity, since that is the only place the $125 billion or more can come from. Thus, as we look about us and as we look ahead, it's clear there's no turning back for us. Of course we need to stabilize our population, but this will take time. Meanwhile, we might as well resolve, before we stabilize our population, we'll have to accept its rise, certainly to at least 275 million by the year 2000. If we accept that, can we still proceed? My answer is yes. We can handle such a future. But to quote Lauren Isley, increasingly there's but one way into the future, the technological way. This means the scientific technological way, with our industry automated more and more, but more and more power vitalized. Thus, we need to continue to expand power. Some of our solutions to our problems will, we know, create new problems, and these too can and will be solved if we have determination to do so and if we proceed along the right route. I'm going to suggest a program. But while this is a program aimed at implementing a broad-gauge public policy in electric power, it's not a projection in vacuo. After all, without any intending any invidious comments or comparisons, the outstanding contributor to air pollution is the automobile. It accounts for over 3/5 of the total, while all, not merely electric utility power plants, account for only 1/7. Again, in water pollution, it is the metallurgical industries, with steel in the forefront, and the food, paper, and chemical industries, and the coal mining industry that are the great water polluters. Electric power affects only one area, thermal rise. I've assumed, therefore, that the program of action I'm about to outline will be a comprehensive and synergistic one, and in it, electric power will play its part. Thus, if we adopt this, it will become an outstanding economic program in the history of the country, because it is necessary to keep the country not only viable, but more productive than it's ever been before during this interval. It's therefore necessary to divide the program into halves, the short-term and long-term program. Now this I've outlined in two tables, which I call 4A and 4B. Only moderate additional comment is necessary. First, let us take a look at the short-term table. Next slide, please. I believe, and these are my only comments, that it is useless to undertake a program of obtaining compatibility between increased energy use and viable environment if our population is going to continue to increase and multiply ad infinitum. Thus, although a permanent program of population reduction stabilization can only be a long-term affair, it is necessary to begin right away. I've suggested as a short-term objective a program that will result in reducing the currently projected United States population in the year 2000 by 12.5% to 280 million. Certainly something more than the pill and other devices will be necessary to bring this about. Why not try the income tax? Why not try and operate on relief? At the present time, the income tax exemption structure is an inducement in many cases to have more children. Since the negative income tax has now become quite a respectable economic item, why not try a negative exemption program? For example, why not increase the exemption for one child to $1,200, keep it at the same amount for two children, cut it in two for three, reduce it to zero for four, then progressively put in a negative exemption up to the point where at nine children, it'll be $10,000. The same principle applies to relief. There is no question that in many families, children are being bred for a living. This is immoral and certainly redounds very badly on our population control. The specific program to discourage additional children as an instrument of additional relief needs to be given careful thought. But I simply do not see why society needs to permit itself to become victimized by unprincipled proliferation. I suggest the cleaning up of our power plants in a period of 10 years and the setting up of effective control in the siting of new plants with regard to aesthetics, pollution in air, atomic radiation, and thermal. As to distribution facilities, I do not see why we cannot set up a program of requiring underground of the most flagrant aesthetically offensive and hazardous situations by increasing the annual construction budget of every utility by 3% a year. Now, why we cannot clean up the existing transmission situations in the same way, but not necessarily by undergrounding, and I would require the annual construction budget to be increased 2% a year for this purpose. To make this effective, I would resort to advisory councils composed of members of the 8 major power regions of the United States, and I would put the burden of planning under the broad guidelines on the utilities themselves. Finally, I would in that period insist on the utilities developing a program of complete coordination on the basis of undivided ownership of all transmission lines generating at 220,000 volts and above, or possibly above 220,000 volts, and in the 8 regional power areas, so as to maximize the use of every structure and every conductor that is placed on the line from now on. This has been done in Sweden. It could be made effective here. As to the long-term program, could we have the last slide? I have stretched a period for its completion to 30 years only because there's a limit to rate at which work of this kind can be undertaken by our society in money and resources if they're to be used effectively. What we're talking about is setting up a NASA program to be continued over a period of 30 years at the rate at which NASA was spending and constructing during the 2 or 3 years of its maximum activity. This is no mean superposition to place on our society. Here again, I've put at the head of our undertakings the stabilization of our population at a viable level. While there's no basis for the scientific judgment as to where that level can be, a good guess is that it might be possible to bring it off somewhere between 275 and 350 billion, million. But on the basis of the past work of our demographers, they will have to start now to determine a reliable goal. I suggest a long series of studies that will call for research in depth on our atmosphere, on our cities, on man in his various stages of life, and the influence of various pollutants on his growth, development, and continued functioning as a healthy, effective human being. A study of energy and energy use, on more efficient generation, more efficient utilization, with a view of getting up possible limitations on energy use, if that is necessary. 2 very serious studies that we have flirted with, but not really very seriously, are the electric vehicle and fusion, the latter promising more efficient generation and therefore lesser use of energy and lesser stress on the environment. Finally, I've suggested the very badly needed study of a better means of handling the energy problem from the standpoint of the national interest by broadening the scope and authority of the Atomic Energy Commission and the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy to cover supervision over all energy. May we have the lights, please? This is certainly one way of getting rid of the disease of fragmentation we have been confronted with and introducing the elements of responsibility and morality and ethics and taking care of the public interest, giving us a viable world, not on the basis of retreat into the caveman period, but of moving forward for man on planet Earth. Since it's quite obvious that for a long time to come, the only future man has is one with his head in the stars and his feet solidly planted on the Earth, he had better implement a program of control of the Earth and water under his feet in the atmosphere between the face of the Earth and the stars within which the Earth itself and all life on it have to live. Thank you very much.
Mr. Sport, I have to criticize you severely. You went 30 seconds over time. Well, we now take a 15-minute break. According to my watch, it's 9 minutes of 4. Let's be back at 4:05, please. I hope there are enough men's rooms around. That was...
but must use our accomplishments as a foundation upon which to build a still better human environment for tomorrow. Business as usual will not measure up to this challenge. The usual business activity of the future must be highly evolutionary, prodded forward by those among us who are constructive activists. I consider myself as one such constructive activist, and I'm sure that Phil Sporn must be numbered among the charter members. I also like to consider myself something of a visionary, but also a pragmatist. I believe in forming judgments based upon practical considerations. When I look at our environmental problems of today through a frame of reference based on results, I must reject the concept that these problems are beyond solution and that the Earth is doomed. Let us look at the present human environment in terms of results. The Earth today has its largest population, the longest average lifespan, the greatest freedom from pestilence, plague, and famine, and the maximum state of human freedoms and absence of slavery and serfdom in the history of man. The quality of human life is on the average higher than ever before, not in spite of technology, but because of technology. In this process of evolving the freedoms and the quality of life for man, the engineer may take justifiable pride. The fact that in recent times our profession has frequently been under attack because of industrial contributions to blight and pollution tends to disguise the fact that from the time that civilization started to evolve, it was built upon the foundation of the innovative builder, the engineer, and more recently the technologist. This is not a time for us in the engineering profession to hang our heads or retire from center stage. Rather, this is a time for us to muster our resources and meet the new challenge, the challenge of providing all of the fruits of our profession to mankind with the least abrasive effect upon his environment, and in fact to apply the technological tools of our profession to the improvement of our environment. It is not my intention to understate the serious and growing magnitude of our environmental problems. As we address ourselves to the choice among the options available to us to deal with these problems, we should recognize that abandoning technology is not an available option for many reasons, not the least of which is the fact that the election to abandon technology is an election in favor of degradation of the human condition. So I then add my voice in affirmation with those who believe that the solution to our environmental problems lies with technology. Unequivocally, we have to find answers to the outstanding pollution problems. Our advanced technology, which has accomplished so much in other fields, must now be turned toward the solution of problems of pollution and the protection of the total human environment. For an opener, we desperately need a better understanding of our environment and identification of the needs of the human side of environment as well as the natural or the nature side. The first step in achieving a better understanding is to recognize that the natural environment evolves. It is not static. Lakes, rivers, mountains, valleys, glaciers, beaches, seas, and all of the natural structures of the earth have life cycles. Among the flora and fauna, the species as a whole, as well as individuals within the species, all have life cycles. While man should avoid unnecessary acceleration and alteration of these cycles, he should not, in fact must not, attempt to stop the natural life cycles. Some of the authors of the recent rash of environmental papers appear to be against all environmental change, no matter what its source or reason. This kind of thinking applied to the past would have opposed the decline of the dinosaur, the evolution of mammals, or the rise of man. Even the creation of the Grand Canyon was an abrasive effect on the then environment. Our society is faced with demands to clean up the environment and to solve urban problems, to increase the standard of living for all, but especially for those whose present mode of living is substandard, and to do all of these things while coping with the problem of the declining quality of our raw materials. There is a limit to the human, the material, the capital resources that can be committed within a given period of time. This requires that we establish priorities of our effort. In doing so, we must recognize that our ability to respond to our needs can be expanded if we can increase total productivity and especially increase the availability of energy. In contrast to those who advocate a zero or negative growth, I believe that continued growth in areas that contribute to society's strength or its ability to respond are not only desirable, but necessary. The principal reason for the magnitude of our current environmental crisis is that we have only recently learned to value our environment. As a total society, we did not recognize the relation between man and environment and did not include environment in our system of values. When I say that we have only recently learned to value the environment of our ecosystem, I do not discount the fact that many of us have been sensitive to the environment for decades. And I include in this the engineer who has been working with the materials and forces of nature. What is new in this area is the sensitivity with which society as a whole is now responding to environmental considerations. There is great value now being placed by society on conditions in which mankind lives, works, and plays. However, we also value our creature comforts. We desire to erase the urban ills, eliminate hunger and want, and to raise the level of living for all. Our needs are great, and with each passing day and with each increase of sensitivity of our society, they become greater, and our resources are becoming smaller. Herein lies the problem that we in technology must solve. It is not enough to raise environmental problems and leave them hovering about as ghosts. We need definition and understanding of these problems. We need to apply our science and technology to develop and evaluate solutions to these problems. And finally, we need a determination of the priorities on which we should base action. So far, most of us have talked somewhat in general terms. I would be remiss and not a proper exponent of my industry if I did not mention several specific problems, problems that are more real than the environmental ghosts that have previously been mentioned. I offer for your consideration these problems wherein we might apply the tools of technology to solve the problems of our society. The first is the undergrounding of electrical facilities. Much has been said and written on this subject in the past few years. Most of the effort that has been applied has been to distribution circuits, which in the eyes of many are degrading to aesthetics when carried on poles on the skyline. Much progress has been made in this area. The tempo, I am sure, will increase, and many of these facilities will go beneath the earth. However, this is not enough. In the coming decades, we must continue the technology whereby higher voltages into the sub-transmission region, and ultimately into the transmission range, will also be placed underground. The second area is low-profile structures. Many elements of physical plant, such as fossil and nuclear stations, substations, and like structures, must in the future either display a very low profile or indeed have major portions placed beneath the surface of the Earth. The third is the much maligned thermal effects of power production. Much has been said and written about what has been called thermal pollution. This is nothing more than the rejection of heat from the generation cycle to some form of a heat sink. It is not enough for we as the engineers to recognize that this is due to a fundamental limitation of the Carnot cycle. We must find ways to minimize the abrasive effects of heat rejection and to mitigate these effects. This is a problem that must be solved, and we must address ourselves to it soon. The fourth area would be effluent discharge as a source of pollution. The discharge of effluents from fossil and nuclear plants must always be a target for our continued efforts to reduce them. Although our track record in this area shows continued decreases in pollutant volumes, we cannot rest upon our oars. Zero levels of emission may be impractical and impossible. Nevertheless, they must be the star by which we steer our course. We must always be intolerant of any contribution of pollutants which we may make from these sources. Now, there are many other problems which I could name as specific examples. I am sure that each of you are aware of many more. I have mentioned four which will well challenge our best technical skills. My strongest admonition would be, let's get with it. If these problems are to be solved, it is the engineer and the technologist, members of our profession, who will be ultimately in the position to provide solutions to these problems. Indeed, our very survival as a profession may depend upon the vigor with which we approach these problems and our success in their solution. In conclusion, I will return for a moment to the general aspects of the problem and make the observation that we must individually and collectively become committed to a new ethic, a new value system, one which will meet our social and moral responsibilities to ourselves, to our environment, and to society, both now and in the future. With such a commitment as a foundation, we can establish the priorities, balance our resources with our needs, provide solutions to specific problems, and still maintain a free society that grows and prospers in terms of the quality of human needs and freedom. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gould. You certainly didn't let us as engineers off the hook. We'll now hear from Mr. Philip Hammond, Director of Nuclear Desalination Program of Oak Ridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gould has made so many of my points that I'm going to just hit highlights of one or two comments and then show you a few slides which give some of the groundwork or facts behind some of our pollution problems. My first general observation is that we must keep rational. There are those who introduce a concern about the environment in a very emotional way and yet don't provide any path for which action can be taken on their proposals. They should realize that the earth without man's works is indeed a harsh and forbidding place to live, and that men's activities have always been undertaken with the objective of improving his own ability to live and make a living and subsist on the earth's surface. And our standards of how we want to live are changing, but the process is still a continuous one. Second, as Mr. Sporn has emphasized, we must preserve our wealth. It's not true that poor people do not pollute. They do indeed, but it's only the rich who can afford to do anything about it. If any of you have ever been to Calcutta or other places in India, you know that poor people do pollute. In fact, there where the principal source of energy is the burning of dried cow dung, they don't have smog, but they have smung. In many respects, the ability of mankind to release and control energy, to get machines to do his work, is equivalent to wealth. So without wealth, we cannot take steps to improve our environment, and we must preserve the productivity of our enterprises in order to be able to do anything. The next point was again touched upon by Mr. Sporn, but I want to emphasize it more strongly. We need to redefine the agencies and responsibilities through which action can be taken. At the present time, the different federal, city, and state agencies through which political decisions can be made and action taken respecting the environment are fragmented in a different way than the problems are arranged. We need, and it'll be a very difficult and unpopular step, to rearrange our institutions so that they fit the problems in a way that facilitates action. My last point is that many of the problems which have been discussed today in terms of the United States only are really world problems as well. We're not the only users of energy. And in this connection, I want to point out that all is not sweetness and light either. There are some substantial problems that haven't even been mentioned today, and I'm going to mention one of them. However, my basic conclusion, I think, can be very firmly demonstrated that energy and the effects of energy are not in themselves likely to be the limit to the population that the Earth can support. That is a separate topic in itself, but I will state it at this point categorically. However, the local effects of energy and its utilization are indeed severe, and we are experiencing those effects now. Particularly the urban air pollution. As you've seen, the effects of heat are more and more being recognized as causing the trapping of pollutants. What's known as the urban heat island is actually the reason why many of our other wastes are kept in the vicinity of the city, and we have to breathe them over and over. So it isn't enough to relieve most of the activities that produce pollution. We must also do something about the waste heat in our dense cities. And I'll show some of this in the slides. Then my last point has to do with the question of whether or not large regional interties for power distribution are or are not in our future. If we can decide soon enough that this is the way in which large quantities of power can be piped around the country, such as big DC or superconducting or other types of intertie systems, we can make much more intelligent and economical decisions about the interim period when we're having to decide whether to build cooling towers or use the ocean for cooling and give us ways for attacking the urban heat problem, for example. Let me have the slides now, and I'll go through these very briefly without discussing them in detail. But I want to just give you some of the basic figures on which people have to discuss the problems. This represents Mr. Sporn's statement that, in fact, the United States and the North Americans use a lot of energy. This is on the basis of kilowatts of thermal energy per capita. North America is 8 kilowatts, the United States is 10, and yet some countries of the world representing large populations are a third or a fourth of a kilowatt. The world average is about 1.5 kilowatts of heat. Next slide. Now here's a form of energy that much of the world is dependent upon. And this is oxen trampling out grain. It's a primitive thrashing machine. And the energy you see being consumed here costs 50 cents to a dollar per kilowatt hour. So when you have to buy energy that expensive, you can't afford very much of it. But the principle is very true, that everybody who can afford more energy wants more energy and will use it. So it's impossible to say, let's give up our energy. Nobody in the world, that's against human nature. We will not do it. Next slide. So here's the cost of various kinds of energy from muscles or from external sources. Next slide. And this is a breakdown of the way in which we utilize energy for space heating and for motive power. You can see that the automobile and the space heating and industrial process heat are very large contenders, each of them nearly over the amount used for electricity at the present time. Next slide. Here's a rough description or a sketch of the urban heat dome or dust cap taken from the Scientific American. Next slide. Here's the interesting meteorological phenomenon that causes these heat islands to trap pollutants. The line that moves from side to side there is the record of concentration of sulfur dioxide as a function of altitude. Going to the right is off-scale or high concentration. You can see it has definitely a ceiling at 300 feet, or is it meters? And the other line shows the temperature inversion. There's a slight squiggle there that shows the temperature has an inversion at that point, and looked upon as the atmospheric phenomenon that causes this trapping of pollutants. The next slide shows that this trapping happens, even though, next slide please, even though the inversion is not detectable by our present meteorological instruments, we still have this sharp peaking of pollutants near the ground. And so I think it's very clear and very important to recognize that some of our atmospheric problems are related to our heat problems. And these heat caps, which are now cover parts of a city, are in the eastern parts of the country, sometimes covering states as well under certain circumstances. And the outside weather just passes over this tent or cap. Now then, with this gloomy picture,